This is Jan Cox, talk number 980, recorded on June 3rd, 1992.
Enkirut said, "The human nervous system, at its upper end, is constructed in such a way that hardly anyone ever notices. And a viewer immediately faxed us to say, 'Didn't you leave out the word can toward the end of that sentence?'"
Enkirut said, "One guy looked through the dictionary to see what he could find. It wasn't there. At least he didn't think he saw it."
And Enkirut said, "All intellectual inventions are flawed in that immediately after they're conceived, they break down."
And Enkirut said, "One man dropped himself little hints, but do you think he was sharp enough to pick up on them?"
Then Enkirut inquired, "How many horses forced to run might believe that a second time around the track would prove enjoyable? How many minds as regards thoughts?"
And Enkirut said, "Taking somewhat of a heroic, cinematic approach, this one chap was given to referring to his own intellect as the miraculous dissolving man."
Enkirut said, "The art of the primary can be summed up as slumber, semen, fat, and mayhem. That of the secondary is not so easily described."
And Enkirut made note of some logic discovered at the bus terminal. A man with cheap ideas can answer cheap questions. Cheap questions have no answers. None of this makes the least difference to the city.
And Enkirut said, "Life talks to every man. Man just keeps changing life's name. One day he may even get it right. But I don't know that you want to be around to see it."
And Enkirut said, "Two out of town voices were talking, and one of them said, 'All art is just a rip-off of the revolution.' And the second one said, 'Yeah, but so is civilization itself.' 'Yeah,' replied the first, 'one thing at a time, old bean.'"
And Enkirut said, "Even when he wasn't getting anywhere, this one guy would tell itself, 'Now we're getting somewhere.' And once he had that down good, he quit telling himself anything."
Then that danseur noble, Enkirut, gave this dancing tip: "It takes two to trip."
And Enkirut said, "Those who don't know what's to be done always believe there's something real serious to be done."
And a correspondent asks Miss Etiquette, "Dear Miss E, what is the difference between serious and important?"
And Enkirut said, "If the revolution didn't have anyone to pick on, it'd pick on itself. The revolution doesn't have anyone to pick on, and the revolution doesn't pick on itself."
And Enkirut said, "In the closet's closet is always a wild man."
And Enkirut continued, "Yet in the mind, only the mind."
And Enkirut said, "An original kid asked his rebellious old man, 'Can the many ever be as slow as the few?' And his papa replied, 'Can you spell institutions?
And a viewer writes, Dear Kairut, as regards this neural revolution thing that you say has always existed in one form or another, let me ask you this. Who would be the closest to it? Those of a religious, mystical bent, or those more sophisticated and philosophical? Dear viewer, which group wears the best shoes?
And Kairut said, One day, as he sat amusing, the king said aloud, Is it right that might should prevail over intelligence? And upon overhearing this, his prime minister made a shocked face and thought, Mein Gott, have they slipped a ringer in on us?
And Kairut said, All kings start out to be artists.
And since he missed our last get-together, Captain Obvious sends us another SIYFD, a special in-your-face delivery. And it goeth like thiseth. Those who figure they won't amount to much, look for heroes. Oh yeah, he addeth. Local gods and civilization just love those who figure they won't ever amount to much.
Then Kairut conveyed some more noise from the domestic health domain. If you knew what you were talking about, you could say that the neural revolution was also like ultimate attempt not to ever let the butler actually buttle.
And Kairut said, In its drive to move the herd, life has caused men to believe several curious things. Oh, okay. Many.
And someone inquires of the advice doctor, Dear doctor, just what is the distinction between caused and made?
The game had been on for several hours, with scores of hands played, when the dealer said, I'll bet you four men with dictionaries against two men with encyclopedias. And the challenger player fell into a coma.
During the morning session, the rebel instructor gave the class this zoological quiz. How can you spot a revolutionist alligator? And, receiving no response, answered it himself. He'd be the one with no tail. Then a bright voice from the back said, Oh, like a history book with no past? And Teach said, I like it. What's your name, kid?
And a viewer writes, Hey, Kairut. I don't know which of two ways this revolutionist stuff you talk about strikes me most, as either being crazy or incomprehensible or extremely valuable. See? Now you've got me doing it.
And Kairut said, Over in this one place, one day, reality told its kid this tale. While everyone else was counting, this revolutionist was running down the alphabet. And an economist writes, Dear Kairut, I don't feel as though you mention the matter of profit often enough on your program, at least not in any manner that I can recognize. Punchline, you know, like a moral and like that. It is those playing with funny money who want to hoard it all.
And Kairut said, A chap standing dead center in the city wants it known that he has never seen any good come from telling people what they didn't want to hear. He says he offers this free and with no sausages attached. Oh yeah, that reminds me of that legend you wanted to hear. There was once a man who quit thinking about God, and God quit thinking about him. I don't know why you guys continue to enjoy such tales.
Then Kairut noted some instructions that do not come with your routine self-kit. Urgency, seriousness, and a fear of tomorrow are the proper fuels to propel the civilization machine.
And Kairut said, one of the speakers in the park yesterday afternoon had this to say, we are all oysters with shells of our own making, and who among us has the taste to plunge the knife into his own crack? I am told that after hearing painted this metaphorical picture question, no one in the crowd cared to respond.
And the advice, Doctor, received this communique. Dear Doctor, why do drugs and what man calls religion seem so compatible? Turning to his assistant, the doctor said, it's nice that not all our inquiries are serious.
And Kairut said, standing before the agitated mob, a voice cried out, no, the monarchy must be preserved at all costs. And a man thought, same too with my mind. So remember, boy and girl mobsters, don't ever let rebellious thoughts into your castle.
And Kairut said, when the ordinary don't know what to do next, they often want to take a vacation. The revolutionists knows that in the secondary realm, there is no leaving town. Dear Kairut, asks a viewer, does this imply that in the primary sense, man is always certain, and only in his civilized affairs is there doubt? Dear viewer, I thought you'd never ask.
And a kid asked the old man, say, tell me the difference between the civilized and the secondary.
Two of the three talking brothers were together one day, talking. And the first one said, a man harboring two different views of the same matter will never know what to think. But the second sibling quickly countered thusly, ah, yes, but a man with two heads will never have to seek outside help to have somebody bite him on the ass. Brother three had to go pick up some plywood.
And Kairut said, once, on a weekend, when he was about half high and thought no one would ever hear about, this one god said to a friend, do you know what man's supreme arrogance is? Seriousness.
And Kairut said, the revolutionist is just like dumb ideas, at least the ones with some intelligence, in that they both want to die alone.
Marching near the middle of the parade under a banner that read, words won't get it, but they'll do until the real thing comes along, was a woman who couldn't be placated, and for very good reason. As it turns out, when she was born, her nieces and nephews named her Auntie Placate. A fellow with a used thesaurus, who didn't get swept up in that earlier poker game, reminds us of his view, which is, men start words, and men can't do a damn thing about them after that.
And Kairut said, without originality, there is no revolution.
The letter reads, dear advice doctor, is it hard to be stupid and be a revolutionist? The doctor says, why are you asking me?
Another Conversation from Out of Town. What my ancestors thought is good enough for me. Ah, yes, and that's why they were your ancestors. After you'd left the room, the guy that spoken first said he didn't get it.
And Kairut said, there is an unrecognized ratio between the expansion of intelligence and of speech.
The thing about being king, said one king, is that you can talk all you want to, and nobody can tell you that it's ever too much. Except you, of course. And you wouldn't do that to you if you were king.
Then, cornering all the kiddies over by the monkey bars, Kairut whipped the surprise recess quiz on them. What do the Philistines fear more than lard-covered hand grenades? Originality. One nipper with a peanut butter and peanut butter sandwich mused, once you're older, I wonder, how many steps is it from being civilized and flavorless to demanding that everyone else follow suit? Later that evening at home, his old man asked him, can you spell inevitable in the present tense and see man's secondary world built on the bodies of discredited artists? Moral. Any artist who repeats himself, even once, is discredited. Son of moral. The city loves a discredited artist.
And the mail brings along this inquiry. Dear Kairut, would a true revolutionist ever plan what he was going to say? And recipient K noted, I don't normally respond to form letters.
And Kairut said, human intelligence is one means by which the universe can change course. And a man, suddenly catching a personal whiff of this for himself, exclaimed to himself, my God, the same has got to be true for man himself. He sweated and shook for a bit, then thought, there has got to be a way I can use this for myself.
And Kairut said, as regards certain mental matters outside of the mainstream, one kid asked his old man, once the revolution is alive somewhere, what can shut it down, kill it? And the elder replied, becoming serious in a routine civilized manner. The old man nudged the kid and added, same thing with your own life.
And a chap wrote to his mama, dear mama, what's the difference between being serious and growing up?
Then, speaking in his invisible voice, Kairut asked some of the troops. There was once a man who knew a lot, but he never told anyone. Did he actually know a lot?
And Kairut passed on this item from the History of Intellectual Affairs, Militaire. The ordinary seek to slay the slain thrice. Delayed footnote. What is it, after all, you think nourishes continuity and feeds civilization?
Just a bit later, this note was delivered to the office of the advice doctor. Dear doctor, would we then conclude that a real revolutionist would leave the dead alone?
And Kairut said, a rebel artist looked upon the city with its many streets of sequence and thought, over there, opportunity is the supreme seducer in that it doesn't actually exist. Men have said they're aroused by that which they cannot have. But what could be more stimulating than that which cannot be? Though loath to so verbalize, many men have found the notion of gods and the truth to be the consummate erotica.
And a kid asked the old man, is that why they say a revolutionist's own mind makes him hornier than anything? Hey, redressed the elder, no one's ever said that. Well, said the kid, they should. They sure as hell should.
And Kairut said, once he comprehended the nature of finite gardens and recognized the continuity of his own planting, nourishment, and growth, this one chrysanthemum would no longer even give himself the time of day. But hey, that's all right. Rebel flowers don't wear goddamn watches anyway.
And kinda off to the side, Kairut noted, regarding vacations, timeouts, and trips out of town, and the like, to a revolutionist, his own mind is the weekend.
Then Kairut reminded, reassured, and frightened the little cities by noting, when raisins are added, even oatmeal takes itself to be original. FYI, several gods, six kings, and a dozen civilizations contacted us to ask if they should take the above personally.
And Kairut said, even after graduating from the tenor to the five string, the rebel picker keeps reaching for the sixth one on his banjo. More dirty travel secrets shamelessly revealed. Ordinary mystics and intellectuals will jump right off the very first time the conductor yells, next stop, a really weird place. Additional free weight and philosophical sweat tip. Anyone who gives up ain't no revolutionist. Period. The end. Fine. Get off the train.
And this letter to the advice doctor. Dear doctor, the more I talk to my dog, the more he seems to sleep. What gives? A woman who used to help handle the doctor's mail would sometimes translate inquiries that concerned animals into questions regarding man's secondary world.
And a viewer writes, dear Kairut, my brother keeps betting me that someday you're gonna quit calling the revolutionist, and start calling him the artist instead.
And Kairut said, over in that semi-invisible camp just outside the city, a rebel sarge told a younger trooper, those who believe that the secret is that there is no secret are like men who suspected the existence of a miraculous train and were satisfied to go to the station and in awe watch it once whiz by.
And a local god takes us to some task, writes he. Heretofore, amongst decent civilized men, the use of parables has been limited to a religious context.
And Kairut said, a revolutionist can resist anything except the revolution. Oh, said a bystander, I reckon that's how you can tell he is one, right?
And Kairut said, A reality and one of its creatures were talking, and the reality said, "Let's play a game. I'll ask you a question. Ready? What is the purpose of being civilized?" And the creature replied, "Whoa, is this a trick question?"
And Kairut said, "Everyone's a prophet, and everyone's wrong."
And today's mail also brought in this letter to the advice doctor. "Dear doctor, which is the cheapest shot at becoming a revolutionist, drugs or education?" "Well, I don't know, sir. Which did you spend the most on?"
Over the PA came the announcement. "Once both teams are on the field, the game can begin." And the lamb turned to Mary and said, "Save the two teams already being present, can there even be a playing field?" And once more, the joy of Mary revealed the pride in her issue.
Station WDNA sends our message for the day. Only the revolutionist can be pleased, impartial, and comfortable with his ancestors and descendants, whether he personally has any or not.
A one-of-a-kind old man told his kid, "The trick to our kind of thinking is to leave out as much as possible."
And believe it or not, Captain Obvious received a letter today which asked, "Dear Captain, would real art be complex or simple?" And upon hearing this, Miss Adequate mused, "It's a good thing that wasn't asked about originality."
And from who appears to be that same viewer from last comes this. "Okay, Kairut, let me put it to you like this. If life does want to know more, why doesn't it just go ahead and tell us? And not fool around with stuff like this neural revolution you keep talking about."
And Kairut said, "A real king makes all lands he visits his own." Then Kairut took a step further. "The revolutionist, as the ultimate cartographer, in that in maps he draws, he names all areas whatever he wants them to be."
And Kairut said, "Fair's fair, and so is fair, thusly. Only the revolutionist deserves himself."
Then, just for fun, Kairut gave this definition without telling what it described. "Those who can turn what they already think into something else."
Then Kairut said, "What is originality but the supreme rebellion?"
Then added, "And what is rebellion but the ultimate originality?"
Meeting, June 3rd, 1992.
Start with a downer, but thanks to you people who didn't send in anything to us, the IRS closed down our Bible school last week. Okay, for you folks out there in TV land, some of the cities we understand are still only getting 30 minutes at a time on these cable shows, so that you will have a little idea of what's going on. The first half, we're taping an hour at a time, and normally the first half of the night is taken up by people reading what's known as the Kairut Papers. It's a stack of stuff. There are one-liners, parables, tales, legends, myths, etc. And as they're being read off camera here is a screen that flashes out the number of the page being read, and people here in the studio audience. None of them were students in the school, thank God. So did they write down ones that strike their fancy in other reasonable parts. And then Kairut signals me off stage, and we have a listed here. If we would like to make an additional comment, he's there prompting me. Prompting or prompting? So here we go. And I'll reread the ones we're going to do. Some of these I will go ahead and reread, and some of them Kairut signals me not to say anything, but I'll go ahead and reread it. And Kairut said, the human nervous system at the upper end is constructed in such a way that hardly anyone ever notices. I'm assuming the way he's insinuated to me, Kairut's insinuated to me that people who ask for these, if I go ahead and read them again, the ones that he does not want additional comment made on, just the rereading of it, such as the response from some people in the audience, takes care of the matter. So to speak, is the additional comment. That's what he said. And Kairut said, those who don't know what's to be done always believe there's something real serious to be done. I'm not even going to look to see whether Kairut wants me to comment on that, because I feel as though he probably doesn't, and yet I cannot resist. Think about it. Think about it, folks, all the way. Every institution, every aspect of sane, civilized, reasonable life, religion, politics, education, your mother, your family is included in this. Those who don't know what's to be done always believe there's something real serious to be done. At least you look in the wrong place, which would be anywhere else but you know where, such as at churches and educational institutions, etc. Look into your own, shall we say, back to the number one Kairut tonight, the upper end of your own nervous system. And being truthful, which I know all of you would be, because most of you did want to apply to our Bible school before that unfortunate incident last week, and so I know that you try to be truthful, straightforward, honest, so as to not besmirch the honor of that Eagle Scout badge that I know your mother has cherished. And so you try to be straightforward and honest. So if you ask yourself this in your own brain, do I always know what to do, what's to be done? And the answer is no. So you're right there. You're at the same level. You're up to speed with the Pope, Chief Rabbi, Harvard, Yale, all the business schools, the Charlotte 500, Talladega, that you too are at the same level that they are, that by and large you don't know what's to be done. And if that is too straightforward for you, you would have to admit, again, assuming that you're trying to be that straight, honest girl and boy scout that I know you want to be, you would admit, all right, sometimes I do not know exactly what to do. I'm human. All right. Then ask yourself, when I don't know what to do, and you always have some speculation, or else you would not be ordinary. Even if you were standing around talking to your best friend, yourself, or even your best friend out here, and you said, geez, what a viscid position in which I find myself. What an emotional, what an intellectual cul-de-sac-y. And he was decent enough not to correct your pronunciation. And you think, maybe he says, well, don't you have any idea what to do? And at first you say, no. He said, you mean you got no idea what to do? You would always say, well, because you would. You'd have some kind of notion. And what is the notion? Even if you're not sure, if you say, well, I'm not so sure myself, but I know from reading, I know from my education, I know from being just part of life, from my own experience, I know that in these kind of instances, other people might do this, they might do that, they might do it. You understand that you would, even if you'd say, I don't know what to do, if you ask yourself, honestly, would you mean that you don't know if there's anything to do, that it's just impossible, you're just in a place that there's nothing to do, that if you're sane, the answer is never yes to that. Because if it's yes to that, you're suicidal. You're not part of life's mainstream. You understand that. So you would, even if you say, well, I'm not sure specifically what I should do, I do know that there are things to do. There are possibilities to do. I'm just not sure which one, perhaps. Now, back to, at least you got lost. You didn't get lost. What would be the possibilities? Even if you think, I'm not sure what to do. And you ask yourself, well, there is something to be done. You go, well, there's got to be. Then you, could you ever ask yourself, would you ever consider, all right, in this, these kind of circumstances, what could be done has got to be something. I'm not sure exactly what, but it would have to be, so to speak, you know, two or three pages from a Daffy Duck cartoon script. No. In other words, those who don't know what's to be done, whenever do you think what's to be done? Well, to begin with, see, this is kind of a dirty trick, which, in case some of you never noticed, a lot of these, what do you call them, Kairut things are verging on dirty tricks. But those who don't know what's to be done, any time that you don't know what's to be done, it's always of a what? Can you sound here? The word serious. It's always of a serious occasion. You understand that? If there was something going on in your life that you had no interest in, say you had no interest in classical music on the radio. None. You're not mad. You've got no interest. You never listened to it. And then you pick up the paper and read. Houston's, I didn't know you lived in Houston. Houston's only classical music station goes off the air this afternoon. And maybe you're staying there with a friend at a bus stop or a stranger. And he goes, what? My God, what's to be done? Assuming that he finds this to be of real importance. And you don't care. You don't worry about it, right? In other words, if he says, what can we do? I don't know. Not only do you not know, you don't care. Right? In other words, if there's no consequence to you personally, if it's not a serious matter, and it arises just theoretically. And somebody says, what can we do? What would you do in these conditions? And you don't care. You got no interest. Then it's not a question. You don't care whether you got an answer or not, right? So that's the dirty trick part. Because this says, to refresh your memory, those who don't know what's to be done always believe that there is something real serious to be done. So if you've got any question about what's to be done, to you, if you're working at the ordinary level, it's always something of a serious nature, right? And so if it's of a serious nature, then even if you don't know the answer, what's going to be the possibilities? You're not going to look around and the possibilities be represented by, well, Daffy Duck, Elmer Fudd, Soupy Sales. Uh-uh. You want to get a little more mystical, when people start thinking about metaphysics, cosmic forces, gods. Does anybody ever picture people sitting around, they want to meditate, do serious things, and they come up and suddenly, has anybody ever said, you know, gone into some kind of swooning medical overload and come out and said, I saw God, and you said, what'd he look like? And he said, have you ever seen a picture? Have you ever seen the drawing, the original photograph from which Alfred E. Newman's drawing was taken? It always looks like they describe, you know, well, God's always, at least in the West, I don't know why, has flowing, long, blonde hair. Other parts of the world, anyway, people say he looks like Buddha. He looks just like the pictures of Buddha. In other words, serious problems have, even if you don't know what they are, have serious solutions. They've got to. There's no other way to look at it. Back to, those who don't know what's to be done always believe there's something real serious to be done. All right, to get off of this one, how about one more slight twist to it? What if you were, whatever we're calling a revolutionist, that you could think some way outside the mainstream, under some sort of control, some sort of purpose? What if you realize the thing about there being areas wherein the ordinary mind does not know what to do next? And then always assumes, I mean, has no choice, that, all right, whatever it is, I don't know. This is a serious matter. I wouldn't even be concerned. And so whatever the possible solutions, even if I don't know what they are, it's got to be serious. What if you could see it in such a way that, uh-uh, that's proof itself that something is a what? Yes? What if that's proof of its non-seriousness? What if that's proof of its silliness? If I don't know what's to be done, then there's damn sure something serious to be done, which I swore I'd get off of, but there's one step from here, the man thinking, well, I'm not sure what to do, and there's something serious to be done. If you don't know what to do, he would take it upon himself. If he was a kind of, they used to call him, spiritual explorer, metaphysical adventurer, they would assume, well, what must be done is something serious. I'm going to cut off my hair, quit smoking, quit drinking, leave my wife, give all my possessions away, and walk, yes, walk, from here to Tibet, and find the answer. What if the answer was closer to a gel out of an Elmer Fudd movie? What if this is the proof of it? Of course, this is a proof of nothing, the way I'm putting it to you now. This is the nature of ordinary life. You got to be serious. Okay. These two were together, in case you didn't catch on. And Kairut said, in the closet is always a wild man. And Kairut continued, yet in the mind, just the mind. May I suggest to you, those of you who have been keeping track, that this would have something to do with the nature of man's primary and secondary world. That in the primary world is just the primary world. Of course, you wouldn't know that unless you had your own secondary world so we could talk about this. But in the primary world is just the primary world. That's part of the dreams of religion. That yes, and many forms of metaphysics and dreams of all kinds of strange activities throughout history, that in some way, if I could go back and get in touch with my natural self, if I could in some way strip away this facade, this superfluous patina of civility that covers my true soul, what would I have? According to Kairut, you would have a wild man. Which I could point out to you, the justice, the ability of life to look after itself is people cannot do that. And those who try and seem to have, quote, any success are very shortly captured by the state and put away. Because this idea that if I could in some way pull away this phony mask of personality, there would be my true self. And those of you that have been keeping up, you know, Kairut uses a closet as sort of a, oftentimes a short thumbnail description of the finite universe in which the ordinary mind apparently lives along with its body. He says in the closet, now, inside the closet, then over in the real part of the closet, is always a savage, a wild man. He put a period. Then added, yet in the mind, only the mind. He didn't put it, but I could put a page 18 or 17b to go to this. He could say, and then Kairut scratched his head in a full dramatic manner and went, Jesus, whatever happened to justice? And, of course, some of you music lovers know that it wasn't long after the original Bill Black died that the saxophone chair was taken over by Bill Justice. But I don't know what that has to do with metaphysics. And from the domain of domestic help, I mentioned this talking myself recently about a Kairut, if you recall, about being able to treat yourself in such a way that your man Friday or Tuesday is always sort of behind you waiting, your own ordinary mind, waiting to help. And you are, the continual distraction. Along these lines, Kairut brought in some more domestic help news. Quote, if you knew what you were talking about, you could say the New Revolution was also like, you could say it was like the ultimate attempt not to ever let the butler actually butle. It's nice to know that even I can affect Kairut rather than vice versa. Over in this one place, one day, Rialto told a kid this tale. While everyone else was counting, this revolutionist was running down the alphabet. This one of these long ones. And an economist writes us, dear Kairut, I don't feel as though you mentioned the matter of profit often enough in your program. And Kairut then points out, like a moral, Those playing with funny money are always the ones who want to hoard it. Who else cares about ordinary intelligence? Ordinary people. Give you the hardcore version, the hardball version again. Kyrie's done several. Who is it that is sensitive about their intelligence? There's very old jokes of a different nature. They used to be sexual that were told in such sophisticated urban areas as Birmingham and Little Rock and Hot Springs. But I'll bring it up to date and take it out of the sexual sphere into the intellectual. Guy walks into a bar right outside Oxford and hollers, "I'm going to whip the ass of every intellectual in here." And everybody sits down their drinks and goes, "Who the hell is he talking to? Who does he think he is? Is that too obscure?" Those who fear an insult to their intelligence, I'll redo some Kairos, have nothing to fear. Or those who most want to defend their intelligence are most within their rights to do so. Those who fear that what you're talking about might drive me crazy. There are two, as always, good answers now that I got you going. One of them is, they have nothing to fear. No one is, you're the one to have something to fear. It's the same thing. But nowadays, in this day of more sexual freedom and et cetera, the more educated, the more sophisticated, the more up-to-date you are, what is the preeminent area wherein sophisticated, educated, civilized people are inclined to be, as they would put it, rightfully, righteously, in a non-religious connotation, within their rights to be offended? Because nowadays you can go into somebody and say, "You sure do walk funny, or when you stand with a drink in your hand, you look kind of funny to me. You look like you might have been a hairdresser before you got in the physics department." Well, nowadays, that's fine. Put you up to a man and say, "You know, I've read some of your papers in the Hairdressers and Physicians Journal. And as far as I'm concerned, I've never seen the work you do on hair. But your ideas in physics, you're an idiot. I got a kid brother who's 12 years old and knows more about physics than you. Now, you're about ready to get your ass whipped." The man's going, "Oh, hit you with his hot iron, his comb or something." It is now people take it as being within their proper, civilized, correct purview to be insulted if you slight their intelligence. Think about it. Now, you've surely thought about it before. If you walked up to Superman and said, "You ain't that strong." Now, we're talking about the real Superman. I ain't talking about something phony. Is Superman going to go, "You can't talk to me that way"? Or is the real Superman, going to hit you and just, knock you to pieces just with one little blow just to prove, when he knows he's Superman and he knows he looks at you? Is he going to be offended? Think about it. Of course, then you get in, if you were old timers, which, if you're into people wanting to defend their gods, "Wait a minute, you can't talk about my God that way." That's another story, and it's really, it should be out of date. But would Superman be offended? And the answer, of course, is what? No. So think about it, that people are offended, take their intelligence. And the guy says, in case you lost your place, the economist says, "I don't feel as though you mentioned the matter of profit often enough." And Kairos, finally down at the bottom here, gives the moral to all of this. And he says, "It's only those playing with funny money who want to hoard it." Who is it wants to be educated? Those in need of education. Did you think that got too everyday and reasonable for a second? Who wants to protect their thoughts? Those that got funny thoughts. That is counterfeit from a revolutionist view. Those who have opinions, beliefs, that are of no consequence, there's nothing wrong with them, but they're serious. They're the ones that want to hoard it. Let's all get together. They join up in institutions, clubs, organizations. So you're a reformed transgressing reformed alcoholic Seventh-day Adventist. And four or five people go, yes, we are too. You all think, oh, well, let's get together. Why? It's to help protect what they got. And what have they got? They want to hoard it. What have they got? Well, according to this moral, I'm just telling you what I read. Kyrie says, it is those playing with funny money in the game who always want to hoard it. Of course, once you realize that, assuming there's some validity to that, look what a relief that'd be. That you see people there, they say, hey, look over there, and you look behind you, and you realize that they grabbed some money off and, you know, stuck it in, and you realize, hey, this is all monopoly money. Did you miss the point? How about an ordinary person insulting you? Putting you on real subtly, they think. Boy, have you been had or what? Of course, if you think you've been had, you've been had twice. You've been had by him, but you really been had. You suddenly fell into your own self-dug honeypot of dumbness. Everyone else is trying to hoard what they got. And once you see where it is, I mean, it's nothing to be upset about, but I was suggesting it might be a certain kind of relief. Let them hoard it. Plus, on the other hand, just notice what you got that you no longer have to protect. Because anytime somebody's trying to approach you with an insult, we're talking about the secondary world, of course, because if it's not that, it would be a primary insult, which is something like a knee to the kidneys or a toe of your boot into the wazoolies, if you're a woman. So that's harm. That's not an insult. So the insult's got to be secondary, but just think, if you understand that all of the secondary world, in a sense, the profit, the way in which score is kept, the profit and loss, is all in funny money. I mean, you've got to invent it. Just like the secondary world, the only way you can keep track is, you know, money's an invention. It doesn't exist. You can hold a dollar bill, but all of you have got to be that aware. There is no such thing. It's bookkeeping. I mean, you can have $10, but you might as well have the banker, which is how it starts. He writes $10, and he takes your $10, and he puts $10 in his own piece of paper that you got $10. And you walk out. You ain't got $10. And he says, yeah, you do. But even when you had $10, when you had $10 bill, you didn't have $10. It's an invention. It's funny money, all of it. But now back to not money, insults. Human relationships. Day old bread. I'm sorry, human relationships. Feelings. No, I'm not going to say it. All of that, from one view, is funny money. So not just other people's, not that you have to worry about them hoarding it. How about this? When they come up to you and say, I know who you are, and I don't like you. I don't like what you say. I don't like what you think. And you realize what they're doing. But it's like they have come up and taken monopoly money and thrown it at you. Ooh. Of course, usually, nowadays, they're more sophisticated. They're first going to flash some funny money on you and say, do you know who I am? And you might go, well, no. They say, I know who you are, but let me tell you who I am. I am Professor So-and-so. I'm Dr. So-and-so. Here's books I've written. Here is lectures I've given. Here is people I've impressed. Here are some of my clippings. All right. That's to show that, hey, I got some funny money here. I got to hoard it. And you go, yeah. And then they take it and throw it at you. That is, I'm smarter than you are. And here's some proof of it. You go, okay. And I'm saying that you're dumber even than you imagine. Well, I guess it's understandable. The more I've talked, I've even taught me something. I now understand why that economist wrote Cairo. You didn't forget that already, did you? Standing before the agitated mob, a voice cried out, no, the monarchy must be preserved at all costs. And the man thought, same too with my mind. If we were which you will assume. May I assume that you will assume that this had some metaphorical possibilities? Not symbolic, actual metaphorical. Because within ordinary circumstances out here in the external world, in a sense, propriety, stability, civilization, government in some form must be preserved. Even if it's going to be changed, even if you're living under... how long did Tito rule after he died? At any rate, if you're living under Tito and you thought, boy, you know, this has got to go, that ain't bad. Tito has got to go. At any rate, if you were still pretty civilized yourself, weren't all that red-assed about Tito and all his goings on, you understand that external revolution out there, anarchy, chaos, is not the way to go. So, standing before the agitated crowd, this whole thing is laden with metaphorical mosquitoes just waiting if you... The agitated crowd, they're there before the king, the center of your own thinking, if we're now going to get metaphorical. The agitated crowd, your own ideas thinking, Jesus, I'm sick of what I think, or half of what I know, I don't even know. Or half of what I know bothers me. Half of what I know reminds me of something that was left over from Tito's garbage. At any rate, there's an agitated crowd. The center, your king. What you think of is your own individuality. And there's this crowd. Always kind of edgy. But a voice says, no. The monarchy, which is a form of stability, continuity, this is ordinary world talking, must be preserved at all costs. That is, we might, you know, undergo change. Maybe we need to. Maybe the natural evolution, the natural selection of governmental external processes may be taking over and we need to change. But some kind of stability, some kind of continuity, some kind of sanity when it's in your brain, if you're ordinary, must be preserved. No revolution, folks. No. We don't need a whole mob of Robespierres here saying, hey, the way you take care of the crown is to cut it off his head and leave his head in the crown. No. The monarchy must be preserved. There's got to be some continuity. And a man somewhere thought, geez, same tool in my own mind. I just did it for you. We out? We be gone, folks. Well, you got 60 seconds? I was going to try to do one more before the tape runs out. And Kyrie said, there is an unrecognized ratio between the expansion of intelligence and the expansion of speech. And connected to it. The thing about being king, said one king, is that you can talk all you want to and nobody can tell you that it's ever too much. Do you see the connection? Especially when I hold them up, you see how... Hey, look at them. You can see the resemblance. Well, that's my youngest. Well, he's almost in third grade now. Then Kyrie gave this quiz to the kiddies. What do the Philistines fear more than lard-covered hand grenades? Nobody liked that one? So I just said greased? Think about this. You're manning your own business, and here comes a hand grenade lobbed in, but you got time to get rid of it. And you grab it, and somebody has covered it in lard. Well, Kyrie and I kind of liked it. What do the Philistines fear more? Than heavily greased hand grenades. And the answer was originality. And one little nipper there that he was asking this about thought to himself, I wonder when you're older how many steps it is from being civilized and flavorless to demanding that everyone else follow suit. Enough of you reacted then, I could have just stopped. I started to stand up and tell him to cut it. But it goes on. Think about it. The kid wonders, after hearing this, how many steps, how far is it, once you start getting older, how far is it from being, once you reach the point of being civilized and flavorless yourself, is it from there to demanding that everybody else be the same way? Of course, just between you and I, you already knew this. It's not long at all after you get grown and take out a mortgage on a house or a heavy car loan, get married, get, you know, paying child support to a few nippers here and there. It's not long at all. you're no longer James Dean or the wild one. Or, you're no longer the easy rider. You suddenly look around thinking, who are all these fuckers riding those motorcycles? Get them off the highways and put everybody in a good Honda or something reasonable. So the kid wonders, how far is it after you get older till you reach the point, and he's just talking about, that you reach the point that you're civilized and flavorless yourself, how far is it from there to demanding everybody else be the same? Brackets within the parentheses. Later that evening at home, the old man asked this nipper, can you spell inevitable? And can you also see that man's secondary world, where man is civilized and flavorless, can you see that man's secondary world is built on the bodies of discredited artists? Remember, this started out about originality in case you lost your place. Can you see? Can you spell inevitable? So that's part of the response to the kid earlier that afternoon thinking, I wonder how far it is from you being civilized once you get older, from you being civilized and sans flavor, to demanding that everybody else be the same. And later, the old man said, can you spell that certain time distance known is spelled, or the word is, inevitable? And also, the old man asked him, can you also realize that man's secondary world, the place where he is civilized, where he becomes civilized, is built on the bodies of discredited artists? Moral. Parentheses within brackets within parentheses. Moral. Any artist who repeats himself even once is discredited. Back to originality, may I point you back? What do Philistines hate worse? What does the stability of the civilized world react to worse than even hand grenades covered in Westonwall? Originality. In the sense of it really being abrupt. In the sense of being revolutionist thought. In the sense of what one person can think if it was suddenly widespread, that would be an active, unacceptable mob, agitated mob at the gate. It would be revolution. It would be the overthrow of the monarchy. And you don't need that. You're talking about hurricane time. You're talking about earthquake. Typhoon. Volcano eruptions. All put together, then put in a secondary package and thrown at you. And I say you, thrown at humanity, thrown at the planet. So nobody needs that. But Kairut gave the moral. Any artist who repeats himself even once is discredited. And then Kairut puts brackets within morals within brackets within parentheses, son of moral. The city just loves discredited artists. Bracket, parentheses, period. Discredited artists are the nature of agitated mobs who calm down. Or put another way, one that nobody asked for tonight, all kings start out wanting to be artists. When you're a kid, you don't want to grow up. This is metaphorical. It's not just symbolic. It's true there, plus somewhere else. There's a difference between, of course, metaphor and a symbol. All kings start out wanting to be artists. Nobody starts out wanting to be a Philistine. Everybody starts out wanting to be Beethoven or Van Gogh or Shakespeare. It's only, again, and this is not the fault, this is the way it appears. I was going to say then again, they end up with a family, with a job, with a mortgage. It's not that that caused it. It's being civilized that caused it. But you start out not wanting to be a Philistine. Kids don't go around saying, boy, when I grow up, I want to be absolutely, I want to give a whole new meaning to such terms as without talent, plagiarist. Nobody starts out wanting to be a Philistine. Nobody wants to be king. That is, nobody wants to be here and stuck here. Nobody wants to be sitting on the throne with a crown on their head. No one wants to have to be the defender of stability and continuity. Nobody wants to grow up. Everybody wants to continue to run out and jump in the mud and throw knives at their kid brother. You know, go up to somebody that looks smaller than you and wonder if you can stick them in the eye with a stick, and you do it. Of course, I'm talking to boys. Mainly girls had your own. I always thought they had their own. I don't know. But boys don't want to grow up, especially look around You know, they try to get their father or some older brother to come out and jump in the mud with them, or, you know, you find this, they've been digging this new excavation out here, and they run off the edge of a cliff, and a caterpillar, a bulldozer's falling down there. A guy's already in the hospital, a driver, and you look at it and think, I'm going to jump off. And you come. But so as not to just have fun by yourself, because kids are not just, you run, maybe, and you get your father or an older brother, and you bring them, and you say, come here. And you say, I'm going to jump. Come on, join me. And they go, you can't jump off there. And you do not want to grow up. You do not want to become a Philistine. You do not want to become the monarchy. You do not want to become a bastion and defender of continuity. You do not want to become a discredited artist, which is what being an adult is, which is what being singing is, which is just simply becoming civilized. You become a discredited artist. The metaphor again is there. It's plain enough. Life's always got it. You start out and you insist that you won't be a musician. And you're out and you play in roadhouses and beer joints and you try your best. You make enough and you live off women if you're a man. And you get by here and there, and you do it, you know, through your teens or something. You get into your 20s, and you've already got a couple of kids hanging around somewhere, and you don't know why. Again, you can say, well, your circumstances called up. It's just life called up. You're becoming a Philistine. Your hormones are getting you, just like they should. And it's like you finally go, oh, crap. And you and you're down with this band outside of... you know, Jacksonville. It turns out you got an uncle down there you hadn't seen in years, owns a body shop. And the club where you're playing just burnt down. You can't even get the, you know, $40 it was owed to you. And you wander over there and he lets you sleep right there in the shop and he says, you want a job? You want to make some money? I'll show you, teach you the business. And you suddenly it's like, ah, fuck it, you know. And so you go into the body and fender work. You become king. You become, and it's like maybe your uncle, no offense to him, and he says, well, I, you know, every now and then I used to hear about you, and your father would say that you're on the road and that you were probably taking dope. You know, and drinking and just doing all kinds of crap and kept saying you're going to be an artist. You're going to be, you know, another Elvis. And you know, son, you got to finally straighten up. I'm going to offer you a decent job. You can sleep here in the garage until you can, you know, get a little money ahead and get an apartment. And it's like you decide, all right, I give up. You have become a discredited artist in a sense. You have become a Philistine. You have grown up. You've become civilized. No matter how you call it, no matter who you try to blame it. And remember, the moral down here is, an artist who repeats himself even once is discredited. All right, once you give up and let your hormones catch up, once you give in to the inevitable, and we don't have time for somebody to say, all right, here it is, somebody suddenly writes in, well, how the hell can you do something about the inevitable? I told you it's too late to answer that. Anybody that repeats themselves is grown. That's part of what being grown is. That's part of what being civilized, is you've got to repeat yourself. You would not be civilized. Somebody might invite you because you're dressed up. Come over here, we're having a civilized party. We are a group of civilized men and women. We have a civilized salon, not a saloon, a salon where we sit around and talk about civilized matters. And so they invite you once, and politics comes up, and you take the right-wing position. They invite you back next time, you take the left-wing position. And they finally said, you're not civilized. Well, they probably say worse, that you're crazy. You know, something's off. You have got to repeat yourself to be sane. You've got to repeat yourself to be civilized. You've got to be predictable. You've got to be king. You've got to be the monarchy. You've got to be stable. So, any artist who repeats himself even once, which is being grown, because now you're no longer an artist, you're a Philistine. But any artist who repeats himself even once is a discredited artist. Then son of moral... the city just loves discredited artists because that's what the city is composed of. The city is not composed of Mozarts and Gauguins. It couldn't be, which again is one reason that artists here and there seem to hold such fascination. And so many Philistines, that is reasonable people, your own parents, you, would sit around in the twin towers of commerce in Manhattan and look out the window and dream of being in Tahiti. dream of the stories you read of Paul Gauguin. Thank God that'd be alive. I mean, there's no chance you're going to do it, but it's so fascinating. But from a world view, from a civilized view, those guys were discredited. A little weird. They're a lot more tolerable after they die. We've been through that. If you're going to be an artist, it's better to die, because then you can get more popular. And not just an artist, a painter, etc. Thinkers, your own ideas. But may I refer you back to last time, there was one guy finally realized, if any survive, none can survive. There's your challenge for tonight. Put that together. I know this one sounded weird. I'm just going to read it because it came out hard. Kairut asked some of the troops. He gave him a little question. He said, there was once a man who knew a lot, but he never told anyone. The question is, did he actually know a lot then? See, I knew if I repeat it, many of you would go, aha. Of course, I trust that that wasn't just a mercy aha you gave me. Like, I mean, some of you are used to, I assume, faking it in your erotic areas of your life, and me saying, did you really aha? And you go, yeah. You could be just saying that to make me feel good. There's a whole nother Kairut. You know, two people told him and said, do you ever fake ahas? Well, this was read good, and I'm going to reread it, because there's a lot more to it, and there's so much, I don't even think I'm going to start to go into it. Over in that, he was in a rebel camp. A sergeant told this little story. Those who believe that the secret is that there is no secret, which is a very old story that was not thought up by 50 California beatnik Zens. It's very old. As long as man's been thinking, as long as man, but 2 or 3 seconds after the first guy thought, first couple of seconds after he thought, then he thought there's a conspiracy because there's something I don't know and they're trying to hide it. And then right after that, here and there, not all men, but here and there, there's always been man popped up like a few seconds after that one. Wait a minute. The secret, the one that I figured that I can't get, the secret is this, that there is no secret. It shows up throughout history. And many people sit down, especially if they smoke a little dope or something, they go, God, that's heavy. Whew. So many people still talk like that. What they're saying, it almost makes sense. That what if the secret is, the secret, everybody else thinks is God or the nature of life and this and that. What if the secret is simply the fact that there is no secret? Very old. Not all that common, but old enough that I'm sure before you met me that many of you here and in the other cities stumbled across that one way or the other and was much taken by it. The way the sergeant is telling it, he says, those who believe that the secret is that there is no secret are like men who suspect the existence of some kind of miraculous train, but then are satisfied to go down to the station and in all once, watch it fly by. My God. And it's like they go, well, all right. Then they can, you know, go home. Not only they can go home, they can talk about it the rest of their life. It's almost like an agitated crowd, almost storming the palace, and almost rushing up to the king, the sovereignty, the continuity of your own thought, the stability. It's almost rushing the throne and getting right to the king and just leap up to his throat, and you could have killed him just for a split second. And oh, you're aware of the fact, I could have killed that bastard. I could have gone crazy in a sense myself. I could have slain me. And you knew it, and that did it. That was all you could take. It's all you could take. It's all you did take. And it's then like you can walk away. Well, most people, they have to. I say you can walk away. It's the old historic feeling of the single, quote, and I'll just use their term, I'm sorry, that single one metaphysical experience, that one conscious blasting moment in your life. Ooh! And it's like all you can take. It's almost as like life lets you take one peek, and then went, I get away, kid. No, I'm good natured. And went, now, gone. You're discredited. Gone. Nobody's going to believe it. Gone. It doesn't mean crap. Gone. And pay your mortgage. And, you know, you understand? It's like good natured. It like, gave you a nudge. Like, did you see that go by? And you went, ooh. And that kind of went, now go on about your business. You know, go on home and take care of business. You know, live out your life and die. You know, come on. Give it up. And it's like, all the little nippers would go home. Like, one time I saw that son of a bitch whiz by. And that's the secret, that there is no secret. That is, they gave it up. I'm sorry, you people, getting this. We're trying to, as I assume you find out, in other cities, once we're on a videotape, we're doing the audio, since so many of you are enjoying the format of me doing the Kairos, and I've been doing them, and I don't get them all done here. On videotape, I've started doing them here in person, and that's what you're doing on audio. And I just got through doing a whole bunch, not to brag on me, but a whole lot of this in the last 2 or 3 minutes was physical shtick. So you imagine, we'll play like it's days of radio instead of television. So you got to play imagine, make up your own mannerisms and theatrical gestures that I just did with them watching the train. Those who one time suspected the existence of a miraculous train, and then were satisfied to have once gone to the station and then all watch it once whiz by. So I just watched it whiz by and I pointed and I made my eyes get big. So you do that at home. But don't get real close to the radio if you just got out of the shower. Well, that was all, except I'm going to read the last two that finished up tonight. I just can't resist. They did a great job. I'm not improving on it, but the last ones was, and Kairos said, what is originality but the supreme rebellion?
That concludes this talk. Be sure to visit us at jancox.com, where you can search through 3,000 talks for topics of interest, or just leave us a message.